This will be interview number one with Walter Malman, taken April 21st in his home. I know that you were raised in Escanaba, but according to my information, you were born in Chicago. How'd that happen? Were you living there, and were your family living down there originally, or did...
No, what happened was my mother and father both, by the way, were pioneers up there. My mother's father came there from Canada along about 1850, and later than that, must have been later, about 1860 maybe. My mother was born in 71, and a brother was born a few years before that, so they were both born in Escanaba. And so he came up there during a period when the timber business was just starting, really. I never knew much about him. And the other grandfather came from Malman, came from Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
What was his name?
What?
What was his name?
Malman.
Yeah, his first name. You know?
Yeah, Peter.
Peter.
Peter Malman. He was born in Sheboygan. I think the grandfather, my great grandfather, I'm not sure, but I think he was probably came from Germany. My mother talked about him several times and said that he didn't have any use for anybody that didn't speak German. And he didn't have any use for his grandson because he married a girl that was English instead of German. And he set up a farm up at Isabella and cut down hardwood trees and burned them to get farmland, and built up a farm that's still the biggest place up there, I guess, and built a house, a log cabin, and my father was born in the log cabin up there, and the thing burned when he was 4 years old. And my oldest aunt was telling about the fire to me one time and said that it was rather amusing because she said, here we are outside in the snow and cold, and the house, the cabin was burning. And she said my father was walking around crying, about 4 years old, and repeatedly said he wanted a kartoffel, in other words, a potato. And at that time, they spoke nothing but German, of course. And so he was, his language was German.
Uh-huh.
But he could smell the baking potatoes down in the cellar who were cooking, apparently. But so the two families they were both born 71 and 72.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, my grandfather was over at Fayette drove stagecoach. I don't know how long he did it, but he did it for a period of time. Drove stagecoach from Fayette over to Isabella, to the Malman place. And my grandfather ran a sort of a halfway house. He had a bar, and they sold groceries to the settlers up there, and clothing and stuff. And also had rooms. He had a two-story house. Pretty good-sized building. It's been torn down now. And my mother was telling about riding with her father on the stagecoach, and they went over to Isabella, the Malman place, and she said my grandfather Malman took her out in the kitchen, and here were three big boys standing behind the stove, kitchen stove, and turned to her and he said, "Kitty, which one do you want?" And she insisted very indignant that she didn't want any of them. Well, she married the middle one, Joseph, later. And then he came to Escanaba, and that's where they were married, incidentally.
That was your father's
house. Yeah. And worked on the ore docks for a while. And then he went down to Valparaiso.
Indiana.
And took a course in bookkeeping. I don't know how long he was down there, but he was down there. At that time it was a business school, apparently. This was probably around 1890, something like that. And they were married in 1893, I believe. And his brother was running a plumbing shop in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And if you recall from history, that the Great Depression was in 1893. They had a terrific depression. And then along around in 1871, I believe, it was a Chicago fire, you remember. And it ruined the entire city. So there was a lot of building going on. And Chicago was booming in many respects, even during the Depression. And he went down and started the shop. His brother went down and started the shop in Chicago, and then got him to put what money he had into the thing, and Dad went down and worked as a plumber for a period of time. And then I arrived on the scene, of course, in 1895. And the brother, as happens in family sometimes, while Dad was home taking care of my mother and the baby, my Uncle John packed up bag and baggage, collected all the money that was out, and sold all the furniture in the office and stuff, and disappeared. And so when he went back to the office after he'd been home about a week with my mother, he went back to the office. There wasn't any. And he didn't have any money. He said he walked down to the, this was up on the north side, up near the park, Lincoln Park, and he said he'd go downtown every day looking for work and couldn't get any. Didn't have any money at all. And so finally my mother's sister came to Chicago, and they packed up and left Chicago, I guess, when I was probably about 2 weeks old, 2 or 3 weeks old. So my contact with Chicago was pretty brief.
Brief, right.
And they eventually landed back up in Escanaba. Uh-huh. And then Dad took on the job of running a company store in Rapid River, which is uh-huh. about 10, 12 miles.
Yeah, I know the area.
And the Scheibel Madden shingle mill was in Rapid River, and this was our company store. And he ran that thing, and we lived upstairs. Apparently, I was, of course, a baby. And then later on, he and his brother-in-law, my Uncle John and Aunt Edith, on my mother's side of the family, they joined together and formed a company and started a store in Rapid River. And that store lasted up until I was 6 years old. I remember the store.
You remember the store.
And it was a grocery store, and there were all kinds of stuff in it. And then he moved to Escanaba and became a bookkeeper for the county treasurer's office. And I remember his salary was $50 a month. And so we lived in Escanaba for a period of years and lived in different parts of the town.
Was it a very big town at that time?
About 14,000. people, 14,000 people. And I was a sickly kid. And every time when school was starting in the fall, I started in school. I don't know how long I went, probably a week or two, and became ill, and my mother pulled me out of school. Mm-hmm. And I did that for a period of years. And finally I came down with typhoid fever in 1904. And
Was there a regular epidemic at that time?
At that time, Escanaba had the, what I believe was probably the worst water supply in the United States. I don't think there was anything approaching except Alpena. Alpena also had a bad one. And they were dumping their raw sewage into Little Beatty Knock. And about three quarters of a mile or a mile out into Green Bay, around the point in Escanaba, was the intake. And all that sewage was going underneath the Stevenson Dock. And then, of course, the water was moving slowly out of the Little Beatty Knock into Green Bay. And so that sewage has just moved right along the land area of the point out over top of the intake. And we had death rates along that period of about 363 deaths per 100,000 population.
Oh my.
And that would mean morbidity rates of about 3,600 per 100,000. In other words, in the town of Escanaba at that time, there was probably, at most any one time, there would be anywhere from 100 to 200 cases of typhoid fever. And so I went through that one. And then that following year, I saw the school an entire year. The following year, I started in. And I've been trying to figure out exactly how old I was. I must have been either very close to 10 years of age, 9 or 10 years of age. And I went to school that fall in the first grade, stayed one day, and the teacher moved me into the second grade. And I stayed, I think, in the second grade about a week. And they moved me into the third grade. I don't know how I had learned to read and write. I haven't any idea. My mother and father, neither one had any formal education, maybe second or third grade, something of that sort. Mother, very poorly educated. And but I could read and write when I started school. And I remember going into the third grade at the end of that week, and they were having a spelling test. And the first word on the blackboard that I noticed was the word machine. And so I apparently had quite a good grasp of the English language at that time.
Now, was
must have had.
Yeah. Was this just a one-room schoolhouse?
Oh, no. City school.
A city school. Oh.
Yeah.
But you lived in the country at the time.
No, we lived in the city.
Oh.
But, so I finally wound up in the third grade. And then the next year I went into fifth grade. When I got into fifth grade, I was with kids my age. So I caught up with the...
I see, yeah.
With the group in 2 years. And, that was a handicap in many respects. I never learned the alphabet. I never had any oral training and arithmetic and spelling and grammar. In fact, all that stuff I missed, most of it.
But you picked it up along the way somehow.
Oh yeah, I picked it up. And then of course, when I got into German, I finally learned the alphabet so I could recite it. Only I could recite it in German rather than English, but it's a handicap to have a thing like that happen.
Yeah.
I had another handicap as a kid that bothered me a lot, and that was the fact that when I started school in the third grade, the they made me write right-handed. And I am strongly left-handed in everything. Everything I do is left-handed. I sometimes think I even think left-handed. But as a result of it, I had an impediment from the standpoint of speaking, of a very high rapidity of speech.
Yeah.
So that it was difficult to understand me. And I can remember going in the grocery store and saying, "I want a pound of butter." And the fellow say, "You want what?" "I want a pound of butter." "I want a pound of butter."
Right.
And that bothered me all the way through school. I hated to get up in the classroom and recite because of the fact that I couldn't slow my speech down. And they kept me on that right-handed writing all the way through high school. And when I entered college, I turned to my left hand.
Did that correct your speech problems and everything? Or had you overcome that before that?
No, well, all the way through college, I would hesitate to get up in the classroom.
Yeah.
I didn't want to recite because I felt embarrassed. I was sure I was going to have someone ask me what I'm asking, and then try to repeat it and not get it, get the question clear. And I always had a fear that someone was going to laugh at me, I suppose, because of the fact that I talked that way. No, I always remember the first class I ever taught at Michigan State. I had a lecture, and I prepared the lecture very carefully. I guess this was a new experience to me. And I got up in the classroom, and I gave the entire lecture in about 15 minutes. And the kids sat there and just listened to me, and they didn't say anything, they just looked. And then I realized that I had 45 minutes more to go. And so I proceeded to turn around and repeat. I repeated the lecture.
Give it to them a little slower.
I tried to be slower on it, and it gradually disappeared, so that I finally found myself and was able to do what I wanted to do from the standpoint of speech. I always remember from college that when there were two things I never was going to do, one was teach school, and the other one was make a public speech. And it was because of this rapidity of speech that I had. And the first job I had with the university, the second job really, I was in the Boys and Girls Club work. About 4 or 5 months, and then I was in the extension service. And the second day I was at work in farm crops, I was called on to talk to a group.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first experience at public speaking. And then later. And years later, when I was in the Department of Bacteriology, I went down to Washington to give a paper. And I always think of that thing. I was the only one down there from the university. And in the room were all of the men that were the original bacteriologists in the United States. And I knew who they were. I had met them. And I was sitting there waiting my turn to get up on the platform. And I'd look at these fellows sitting around in the audience, these very prominent men that were ultimately famous men in bacteriology. And when I walked up the aisle to give that talk, if someone, I think, had hollered boo, I think I'd have gone out the door. God, I was nervous. And because I thought, of all things, here I am, a young individual, walking in and giving a lecture on research to a bunch of people that were the top bacteriologists in the United States. I expected they were going to murder me, but nothing happened. Everything worked out all right.
Now, back in Escanaba, did you live in town the whole time you're growing up?
Yes, we did. We lived in houses, by the way, that didn't have it. They had water supply, contaminated water supply, but no bathroom, no toilet facilities, outdoor privies, and we went through three houses like that with privies and no toilet facilities. Baths were taken on Saturday nights in a wash tub out in the kitchen. And the youngest one of the family got the bath first. I don't know how often they changed the water, but I think we got pushed through the same water for the kids at least, anyway. But my mother and father took a bath in the tub, wash tub. So it was quite an event when we finally got a bathroom installed in the house.
Uh-huh.
And then when we got electricity,
what was that?
That was interesting. Escanaba had electric plant, but they only ran electricity at when it got dark.
Uh-huh.
They turned on the juice
huh.
probably around 5 o'clock at night in the wintertime. And so Dad finally had them wire the house. What they did, they simply run the wires out on the ceiling.
Sure.
Two wires out and then I dropped a wire down with a light on them. And that was quite an event, incidentally. And our heating system was a stove. And I've often thought about that stove over there when they bought this one. The statement made by the people that manufactured was that it would heat a room like this, way over there, heat this room. And I questioned that. I didn't think it would do it. And we put it in, and the amazing thing is, it even warms the bedrooms down here. And this winter, all during winter with that stove running, this house was warmer than it was when we were using the furnace.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when the sun was shining in here, it get too warm. It got up to around 80 degrees sometimes in here this winter.
I bet it got pretty cold up in Escanaba sometimes.
Well, I think what the trouble was the houses weren't insulated.
Uh-huh.
And the windows were single pane. Nobody used storm windows up there, as I recall. We never had any. And probably the reason we had to hug the stove to keep warm at nights was the fact that the leakage of all around the walls and stuff was so high that when you got a short distance away from the stove, there was more cold air coming in than there was heat coming out of the stove. And so the house was cold, except in the immediate vicinity of the stove. Kitchen was fairly warm, and the kitchen stove was running. But that was a smaller room, of course, and you kept a big fire in there. For cooking purposes. But I was amazed at the stove here, the fact that it kept this place so warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rather interesting thing. I wasn't very enthusiastic about doing it originally. Mrs. Malman was quite interested in it.
Now, in Escanaba, when you're growing up, what kinds of things did you do for entertainment in those days?
Oh, we had moving pictures.
Oh, was there the theater house there?
Yeah. The Theatorium.
The Theatorium.
5 cents. And the films were terrible. And you've seen some of them.
Yeah.
They run them on the same. The piece and people kind of jumped around a little bit. And there was lots of hand activity and to try to show what was going on
sure.
and so forth, because there was no voice in the thing. And in fact, we had a picture. My father took me one time when I was a little bit of a kid to a place that was sort of in a museum sort of a thing on the second floor of a building. and they had a projector there, and they ran a little picture that probably lasted about, I suppose maybe 5 minutes. And I remember it was a war picture, and no plot or anything, just a picture of soldiers running. And these soldiers with guns were running up a hill. And that's all there was to it. But it was a moving
picture. Little action.
It was a moving picture.
Was the Theatorium the sort of cultural center for Escanaba at that time? Was that the fanciest place in town to go?
Yeah, that was the only one in town for a while. Later they built a theater there that was fairly decent. And movies developed very fast, incidentally, as you probably recall. So that they were pretty decent, and then it began to be plays and stuff instead of just just a demonstration of a moving picture. But it was lots of fun. Of course, we did a lot of skating and skiing and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
I have a pair of skis downstairs that were made for me when I was about, probably about 12 years old, I think, something like that, 12, 13. A Norwegian got jailed for being drunk. And my friend that I ran around with as a kid, named Arthur Arnson, his father was sheriff. And my father was county treasurer at that time. And we lived just across the street from the courthouse, and of course, in the jail. And Art, of course, lived in the jail. And so I spent a lot of time fooling around in the jail with prisoners. We used to get prisoners out and play cards with them.
What did your parents think of that?
I don't know if they knew what we were doing. But the turnkey and the fellow named Perrin, a young fellow, would get some fellow that was in jail maybe for being drunk or something, that was maybe had a 30-day sentence or something like that, and he'd let him out, and we'd sit there and play cards. And this Norwegian, was a ski maker over in Norway, and we got talking with him, and he turned to Art and he said, "If your father will permit me," he said, "if you get some ash boards," he said, "I'll make you a pair of skis." And so Mr. Arnson let him go down to the basement and make skis for us. So I still have those skis.
Hmm.
They're wide, they're about that wide.
Uh-huh.
And they're nice skis. I've used them out here recent years.
Were there a lot of Scandinavian people up there at the time?
Yes, a lot of Scandinavians. Escanaba particularly, a heavy population. The northern nations of Europe, the people over there, moved into this country in large numbers, and they seemed to move, the Norwegians and the Swedes and the Danes, to move to the cold country rather than warm country.
Sure.
And so they went up in the Upper Peninsula, and they were in the timber business, and farming, and it was a pleasant place to live as a kid.
Timber and farming primarily what was done up there? That's about it? Any mining or anything?
No, we're away from the mines quite a ways. Mines are up around Ishpeming.
That's right, yeah.
Iron Mountain. But the ore docks are there.
Yeah, and you mentioned Fayette earlier. Was that still in operation, the ore smelting place there?
No, that went out of operation about around 1890, I think, something like that. 1885, 1890. And see, that was a charcoal furnace.
Uh-huh.
And we had a charcoal furnace at Kipling on Little Beatty Knock near Gladstone. That was a charcoal furnace too. And that closed up many, many years ago too. There's another one up there near Marquette. I picked up some of the glass from the furnaces up there.
Mm-hmm.
I collect stones. And I didn't know that one existed until I was up there a few years ago.
Hmm.
Bumped into it. So there were at least three anyway. There may have been more than that. I never checked to see what.
Anybody in your family in the iron business or the timber business?
No, timber business. Yes,
yeah.
My father had the land and timber company. After he left the courthouse as county treasurer, he started a company called Land and Timber. Their main product was pulpwood.
Huh.
And at the peak of it, along around about 1918, he was probably producing more pulp, most of the pulp, more pulpwood than any broker outfit in the country. And all that stuff was shipped by water, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, I grew up in that thing. And I was always getting jobs with my father's company, doing some darn thing on peeling post or getting on the tugs. We had two tugs and a lot of boomsticks, of course, for rafts. And one summer, part of the summer, I was boom master on the tug. And we were in a storm out on Green Bay, and the tug couldn't hold it. The darn raft was moving backwards, the tug pulling, but it couldn't pull it. The wind was so heavy that it was pushing the stuff back. And we spent the day off, just offshore, about maybe a quarter of a mile. It was a raft of pulpwood. No, that was logs. A bunch of logs in the raft, and we'd pull out on the corner of the, take one end of the part of the raft and pull it out, because we could pull part of it. We'd pull it out into the lake and then drop an anchor and anchor the thing, and then go over and get on the other end of the raft and then pull that out and into the lake. We did that all day long. And I was in a rowboat most of the time, tying the ropes to the raft. And as soon as it got one pulled out, of course, the anchor would drag, because it was too much for that anchor. It would drag, but it would hold it enough. So by the time it got the other one out, we could get back to the other end of it and pull again. We kept it off the shore. The storm finally quit, and we had it safe. So they went off with it down to Green Bay to deliver it to the mills down there. But he had a very good business. He went broke in 1923, lost everything. They grew too fast. They didn't have enough capital to swing it. And of course, in the logging business, you finance the people in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the season's over, you don't get your money back out of it until you deliver the timber to the mills. And so there'd be a period there of about 6 months, probably, that you had to have a lot of credit, because
mm-hmm.
you'd have all this stuff on the shores piled up, ready to put into the water and then move it, deliver it, and get your money out. Well, they took on a big mill up at Kenosha, I think it was, and they agreed to produce all of the pulpwood for the mill, and that practically doubled their business. And they went broke because they ran out of money along about this time of the year, and they still had to finance the business until sometime maybe in July or August, when they'd be delivering timber. So they went busted.
Did you ever do any work on the logging camps themselves, back where they're working timber?
I didn't work in them, but I was in them.
You'd visit.
I visited them.
Where were those located?
Well, we had one. We had one called the Savoy Camp. down near the Cedar River, that's south of Escanaba, toward Menominee. And to get to the timber, it was all hemlock. We had to go through a swamp to get the timber. So we had to build ice roads. And you should have seen those. Gee, those things were beautiful. They went through that swamp and built an ice road. And the sleighs were 8 foot, 8 foot sleighs. In other words, 8 feet wide. Uh-huh. The runners were 8 feet apart. And they built that ice up until it was thick enough to support a load of logs. And then they had what they called a rudder. It had a set of chisels about that wide that were put in for at a distance of 8 feet apart. And then they would drag this with a team of horses, and that would cut the ice out, and they'd finally wind up with a rut about that wide and about that deep.
About 4 inches wide and 2 inches deep.
Yeah, that's in order to keep the runners in place.
And they made these roads just by pouring out water out of them and letting them freeze?
Yeah. Yeah, they had a big sleigh with a big square box on it.
Uh-huh.
It was, they filled full of water. And then they go back and forth with that and spraying it day after day and keep building up ice. And they continued that thing all during the winter.
What'd they do after winter?
No, they were through then. As soon as, as soon as the warm weather got in, you were done. But I remember going down there with my dad and then a cutter with a horse and riding down those roads. And we drove down, just like it was a beautiful highway, like a concrete highway, you know. And the trees all covered with snow on both sides of the road. And here's this beautiful, nice, wide, clean, smooth road. When they would load those sleighs, they'd load the sleighs and they'd be ready for movement in the morning. And they would freeze in position on the road. And then they would take two or three teams of horses and hook them up on that thing and break them loose, break the sleds loose. And there'd be a pile of logs on there, no higher than this room, on the sleds. And as soon as they got the sleigh moving, then one team of horses could handle it. And on the hill, there's a hill, pretty good hill on, as you went down toward the lake. And when they got down there, they put straw on it every morning, fresh straw, to slow the sleds down, because there was no way to break them. And if they ever got loose, you'd get killed the horses and everything else. They never had any accidents on them.
Never.
You know? The food in that particular camp was excellent. Mrs. Savoy did the cooking, and she did a good job.
They have a big cookhouse there.
Yeah.
Everybody get together for meals.
Yeah, they had the sleeping quarters were simply single boards, not tied together at all, just ordinary rough boards with cracks in them. You could have seen outside, but then they put tar paper on the outside, and that's all the insulation they had, and the roof had tar paper on it. And then the bunks were built into the side, a lower bunk and an upper bunk. And then they would put straw in there for a mattress. And then you get in there with in your blankets on the straw in the bunks. And then they had a long stove that took cordwood. So the stove was over 8 feet long. And that thing would go from here probably over to there probably. And they'd put the hardwood in. Then over top of it, they had wire strung both ways over top of the stove. And when the fellows would come in from work at night, they'd take their socks and hang them up there to dry because their feet would sweat.
Sure.
And the air had a pretty heavy odor to it, incidentally. And I slept in there once or twice. And I remember sleeping, I had an upper berth. And the fellows on the lower berth would get cold. And all of a sudden you'd hear someone swearing. Some guy would swear and he'd run over and he'd open up the drafts on the stove and maybe throw some more wood in and then go back and get in bed. And pretty soon you'd hear someone swearing because it got so dang hot in there. They couldn't stand it up on the upper berth. And some guy would jump out of bed and run over and open the door, close all the drafts on the stove and then open the outside door and go back into bed again. That went on all night. The temperature would fluctuate, I suppose, maybe 20 degrees or more during the night.
About how many men were camped there?
Oh, probably, I don't remember how many they had there, but probably 20 or 30 men, something of that sort. There was one interesting experience up there later years when my father was up in Crystal Falls. I was down here then. This was in the late 20s. And you remember when you remember the back, long before your time, of course, of the sit-down strikes that started over, I guess, in Flint. And here in East Lansing, it was terrible, with that sit-down strike. And they got up into the logging camps. And Dad was working with a fellow named Herman Holmes up there that had some camps running. And Dad was bookkeeper for the company. That's after he went broke in 23. And a fellow came in and he said, Mr. Malman, he said, tell Mr. Holmes that we've got a sit-down strike up at such and such a camp. And so Dad went in and got a hold of Holmes. And Holmes had a foreman. I think his name was Gonya. He's a big Frenchman, big man. And he was quite indignant. My God, they're striking, eh? And he'd stand there and swear, you know, to him, fools, they didn't know what they were doing, so forth and so on. And he said, well, we'll settle out of Hooper. He turned to my dad and he said, Joe, he said, get your coat. And he said, we'll go up there. So Dad and the foreman and Holmes got in the car and drove up to this camp. And they walked in and Dad said, here were these fellows all sitting on the bunks around the bunkhouse, just sitting there. And they were striking. And Holmes said, well, you're supposed to be out in the woods working. No, we're not going to go back to work until we get a raise in salary and so forth and pay. And so they sat there. And Dad was probably then about, 68 years old, something like that. And Herman Turner, his foreman, he said, we'll take care of this. He said, take off your coat. So Herman was a big fat fella, Swede. And he took off his coat and vest, laid down on a bunk, walked out in the middle of the floor, and the foreman went down to the other end of the line and got out on the middle of the floor with his coat and vest off. Holmes said, all right, we'll take you one by one. Who's first? And both of them were in the late 60s or early 70s. Anyone could have knocked them out, you know. Dad said, here, these two damn fools, two old men out there, standing there with their arms crossed, waiting for the fellows to come out one by one, going to lick the entire camp. And Dad said they sat there for a few minutes, and all of a sudden the men got up and walked out, went to work. And Holmes turned to Dad and he said, that's the way to handle men. He said, you got to handle them. And he said, if they'd come up, he said, we'd have licked them. He said, by God, we'd have licked every damn one of them. We had one crew, a French crew, French-Canadian crew that was working for us. And one time they were loading hand-cut ties into cars out of the lake, into boxcars. And those darn logs, they're all cedar, you know, mm-hmm. cedar ties. They were even slimy from being in the warm water, and they were wet, mm-hmm. cold, heavy. Not cold, but heavy. And Dad gave me a job of timekeeper to go down there and take care of them. So I went out to the camp where they were, not a camp, but out to the place where they were loading the stuff. And they had a raft out on the water, and then a conveyor belt going up into the car. And they pushed the logs up, they pushed the ties up into this thing and ran them into the car. And about four men in the car, two men would grab a tie and pile it until the car was filled. And the Frenchman that ran this crew, he hired nothing but Canadian Frenchmen. They talked French entirely on the job. Wanted those ties about that far apart going into the on the conveyor.
Just a couple inches.
Yeah. And this fellow was out on this raft with a pike pole pushing these things onto the thing, and once in a while the wind was blowing, the ties would be moving away from the thing, so he'd have to stop and get a bunch of them and pull them over, and then the conveyor belt would be empty.
Mm-hmm.
And Gagne would holler at this fellow in French, and the guy was working, he was working hard. And finally Gagne went down on the raft, talked to the fellow in French, fellow standing with a pipe bowl in his hand, and then he slugged him in the face. He just gave him a tea, gave him a beaut. And the guy just went kaplunk into the lake, pipe bowl and all. And the guy came up and started swimming to shore. And when he got to shore, Gagne fired him. And so I came home and told my dad about it. And Dad said, "Well, that's got to stop." He said, "I don't like that kind of stuff." He said, "That's a good crew," and he said, "I think very highly of him as a foreman. He's a good man, but," he said, "I don't tolerate that sort of stuff." So the next day he called Gagne in, and when he got him in there, Gagne said, "Mr. Malmen," he said, "I have the most productive crew that you got." Dad said, "Yes, I'm sure you are." But he said, "I don't like you to do that." And he said, "That's the way I make my men work." He said, "When a man comes on that job," he said, "he doesn't dare quit. Because he knows if he says he's going to quit, he's going to get licked." He said, "He doesn't dare quit." And he said, "If he slows down," he said, "he knows he's going to get a wallop." And he said, "You just leave me alone. I know how to handle these French Canadians." I don't know whether he ever quit after that or not. Those were pretty rough days.
Yeah, I guess. You said that they were the best-fed loggers around. Kind of, who did they get?
Well, actually, from the standpoint of nutrition, it wasn't good food.
Uh-huh.
There was no refrigeration except ice.
Yeah.
And in a camp like that, they would probably use stuff out in the snow in the wintertime, keep it cold. But the meat was mostly but pickled salt meat, salt beef and salt pork, and then canned goods. No fresh vegetables of any sort, except potatoes. They have potatoes, and well, they might get some carrots sometime, or turnips or something like that once in a while. But during that period, in the grocery store, there was no green goods. You went to the grocery store, and you could buy potatoes, and you could buy oranges, bananas, and that was about it, because you only got fruit and vegetables in season.
Sure.
And this was true at home. You lived pretty much on canned goods and maybe something that your mother put up, or you bought stuff in the store. So your vitamin intake was not very good. And oranges were relatively expensive. Bananas were relatively expensive. Remember that butter, for instance, would be 5 or 6 cents a pound. Eggs would be maybe 10 cents a dozen for eggs, and everything was cheap. But then your income was low.
You sure?
And as I recall, as a child, my father was getting $50 a month. We lived a pretty decent life, and my mother was an excellent cook.
And you had a fairly large family too.
Three younger brothers. But
hi. How are you?
Hi.
But it was pretty decent living. But as far as the vitamin intake was concerned, it probably was pretty low.
Uh huh.
And so that when summer got around, you got your green stuff, and then you began to get pretty much of a balanced nutrition probably during the summer, but during the winter you didn't. But it was rough, really. And remember that we didn't get the first vitamin, you see, was discovered just after the World War I.
Uh-huh. Would you like to take a break or something?
Yeah, fine. Mm-hmm.